This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, the students score a win for Honduran workers while tackling university budget cuts.
But first,
whether it's the swine flu or another illness, workers shouldn't have to go without pay, risk retaliation, or even lose their jobs when they're sick or need to take care of a sick child. But that's the situation for 1.8 million New York City workers, and it's not just unfair for them, it's a public health risk.
The New York State Paid Family Leave Coalition sponsored a rally on the steps of City Hall where community, labor, and public officials gathered along with Speaker Gloria Steinem to show support for New York City legislation mandating employers to provide paid sick leave for workers. Well, guess what? That's pretty amazing. What? Workers here don't have any paid sick days? Well, we're going to find out a lot more. So now to the City Hall rally for paid sick leave now.
All right.
I'm Donna Dolan. 2 years ago, our Paid Leave Coalition made a commitment to work on paid sick days for New York City workers. There has been a growing drumbeat of support across New York City, across organizations, with our elected officials, more and more of them coming on board on this issue. And we would like to kick it off with our bill sponsor here in the City Council, Council Member Gail Brewer, our committed, persistent, and tireless sponsor of the Paid Sick Days Bill. Gail.
To the credit of this coalition, we have met with over 30 or 40 different people getting input on this bill. What is very clear from San Francisco, Washington, D.C., and here is that people in New York City, many of whom do not have paid sick leave, a million or more, no matter whom we talk to, this is a bill that is about, we want to make sure that workers can really stay home if they're sick or if their child is sick. The worst thing you can do is get a call from school and worry about getting fired or not getting paid if you want to pick that child up, which is incredibly important. It is not a lot of days. It is an earned paid sick leave. You have to be on the job for quite some time before you actually get to participate in the program. This is a bill that has a lot of research and is really important to the public health of the city of New York. And that is why this bill has such a huge coalition. And now it's my great honor to introduce Gloria Steinem. We had the pleasure of celebrating her recently for her 75th birthday here at City Hall. We gave her a proclamation. She is somebody we know as a leader in the women's movement, founder of many organizations, including Ms. Magazine, a great writer and a great thinker. She's a person who cares and who has been talking about workers and women her entire life. It is a great honor to present the great Gloria Steinem. Yeah.
When I told people that I was coming here for this rally, no one could believe that we didn't already have paid sick leave. We are the only industrialized country in the entire world that does not have paid sick and family leave. This is an outrage, and it's a special outrage because it is centered on the 1.5 million poorest workers in this city. And they are also the majority of the parents of kids in public schools. They have a double reason that they need this legislation. Women need this legislation more than anyone else. Women still have so much more family responsibility than men that economists are now referring to family responsibility discrimination. That is the form that sex discrimination is taking. So there is no excuse here. This is in the long-term self-interest of everybody, including business. Every study shows that if you scrimp on this money now, you will pay more money later. Those people without paid sick leave are much more likely to send their kids to school sick, to go to work sick themselves, and to end up in emergency rooms that cost a lot of money. This is a minimal kind of demand. It is humane, it is necessary, it is good for all of us. I call on all of us and our city council, whose heads are connected to their hearts and to their common sense, to get paid sick leave done now. What do we want? Paid sick time now. Paid sick time now. Thank you.
Okay. Next, we'd like to call up our new controller in New York City, John Liu, and the executive director of A Better Balance, Sherry Lewand.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I'm delighted to join everybody here, this massive coalition that has been built over a period of 2 years, and to join my colleagues in the city council. I'm very proud to be a co-sponsor of this legislation. It is high time that we bring some of the standards in this city up to modern-day standards. And that's exactly what this is about. This is about a workforce that we clearly need in New York City, but one that deserves a bit more protection, one that deserves to be treated in a professional manner. The naysayers will say that this bill will cost a ridiculous amount of money. That is absolute nonsense. They have exaggerated the claims of this cost incredibly. You know, people work hard day in and day out. And when they get sick, they need to stay home. It's for their benefit as well as everybody else's benefit. So we need to express a little bit of professionalism for our workforce here. And the fact of the matter is, the people who are hurt the most when they do not have paid sick time are women, as was mentioned, are many times immigrants, people in the lowest paid jobs, people who do the most difficult work that New Yorkers rely upon on a day-to-day basis. They need a little bit of protection. That's what this bill is about. It's about protection for our lowest paid workers. It is about making our standards more uniform. And it's about recognizing the fact that the income and wealth gap in this city has increased over recent years. We need to take measures to narrow that gap. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sherry Lewand. I'm executive director of A Better Balance. We've been helping to lead the New York City Coalition to try to get paid sick days in New York, and also been involved around the country. And I'm here to tell you this is a national movement. San Francisco has done this, and Milwaukee has done this, and Washington, D.C. has done this. There are 14 states that have proposals as well as the federal government, and it is time for us to make sure that every New Yorker has paid sick days for the health of all New Yorkers and their families. And let's get this done this year, guys. Yeah.
Robert Jackson!
Thank you, Gail Brewer. Thank you, all the coalition, for bringing us here today. And in fact, I have to leave shortly for a doctor's appointment. And that's the truth.
It's a dentist appointment.
But let me just say this to all of you. That... Do you want an employee coming to work that's going to work with food or around people that is sneezing and coughing? Hell no! And everyone, all the medical experts said, if you're sick, if you have a fever, stay home. I cannot stay home if I don't get paid. Who's going to pay the rent? Who's going to feed my family? That's what this is about. Thank you.
Okay, I want to ask Vice President of the UFT, Rich Farkas, to come, and then two workers that are with us, Gabino and Shalesh from Rock. Come on up together.
The shame and tragedy of this is that in the greatest city in the world, we're still talking about this issue. and teachers all across this city will tell you that a kid gets sick, gets 101, 102, he's sneezing, he's coughing, he's sleeping in class. They send him down to the nurse. The nurse calls the home. The parent can't pick him up because they can't leave work. The next day, the kid's back in school. This is a tragedy. This should not happen in our city. Paid sick leaves now.
Hector first.
Okay. So, este puño sí se ve. Brothers and sisters, what the brothers and sisters are chanting is very true. Workers' power, this power has to be seen in this council today. I'm Hector Figueroa. I represent 120,000 building service workers, 70,000 of whom work and live here in the city of New York. And our members have the benefit of years of struggle of having under the contract sick days. However, we represent not only our members, we speak for all building service workers who are without a union and all those New Yorkers who are without a union and do not have sick days provided in the workplace. And we're here to say with this coalition that the time is now to have sick days be mandated in the city of New York. We are losing too many people to health issues because they cannot take a day at home, be taking care of themselves, and instead they go to work sick because they are afraid of losing their jobs. That has to end in the 21st century. We are meeting many challenges of public health and having our workers in the city be forced to choose between their job and their well-being is absolutely unfair. It is completely oppressive. So we are saying here today, let's establish the sick days mandated by this city council. Let's have New Yorkers have the choice to be at home to take care of themselves and their families. The time to do it is now.
Hello, rocks! Let's rock! Sick days! Now!
Now! Well, the often raucous student movement had achieved its biggest victory so far. United Students Against Sweatshops pressure tactics forced one of the nation's leading sportswear companies, Russell Athletics, to agree to rehire 1,200 workers in Honduras who lost their jobs when Russell closed their factory soon after the workers had unionized.
In addition to organizing against sweatshops here and abroad, USAS is active in fighting against university budget cuts, tuition increases, and layoffs, including the campaigns that led to a wave of mass demonstrations and occupations at the University of California. We're joined by Jack Mahoney, national organizer of United Students Against Sweatshops, USAS, and Sana Javed, USAS activist and senior at the University of Maryland.
So do tell us about this wonderful, important victory and how it was realized.
As you mentioned, this was a factory where in October of last year, after a long union organizing effort by factory workers, there came to be a point in the negotiations between Russell, the company, and the workers' union where Russell didn't want to budge on giving higher wages, didn't want to budge on a number of other things workers were asking for. And so instead of continuing negotiations, on October 8th of last year, they announced they would close the factory. This was after Russell had, similarly, earlier that year, had closed its only other unionized plant in the country. So it had effectively had stamped out all unions in its facilities across Honduras, where it's the largest private employer. And so to go from that point for a year ago to now, when for the first time ever, a company who's cut and run from a unionized factory has been forced to reopen the factory and rehire everyone, is really an unprecedented accomplishment in the 12 years of our organization's work.
Jack, give us just a synopsis of the campaign that was led by United Students Against Sweatshops that brought us to this point.
Over the last 12 years, students at nearly 200 campuses have gotten involved with United Students Against Sweatshops, and through their action during all of those years and a number of different campaigns, students at a lot of those campuses have gotten to a point where administrations have been forced to take them seriously and realize that when they raise issues, it's serious and that they need to do something about it. And so when we began supporting the factory worker union's call for a boycott last fall, it was slow at first, but by the time February of this year rolled around, we started getting this unprecedented wave of licensing cuts, which basically means universities have major, major licenses with apparel corporations to make their university logoed apparel. We've, over the last 12 years, pressured many of those schools to include worker rights codes of conduct in these licensing agreements. And so we were able to not only make the case, but with student pressure on the ground, force nearly 100 universities to sever such licensing agreements or any other sorts of business they had with Russell. And this was the biggest collegiate boycott of a single company in history that we're aware of. And we think that among any of the other tactics we use, is probably the most important factor besides workers' resilience on the ground itself that led to this victory.
Sana, how did you get involved in this fight, and what did it look like at the campus where you are, the University of Maryland?
At the University of Maryland, we're United Students Against Sweatshops, affiliated group Feminism Without Borders. And we've been working for a while to sort of raise awareness on campus, especially about our apparel and at what cost do we get to have these sweatshirts and T-shirts and sweatpants with our logo on them and where they're made. So that's really how I got involved, especially from the feminist perspective, where the majority of the people working in these factories are women. And so coming in through that venue was how I got involved. But on our campus, it was really interesting because after the worker tour came on our campus, and here we listened to these union leaders talking about how, essentially everyone in the factory was fired, the factory was shut down, and how we have sort of more than just guilt, but we have a responsibility and an accountability that if we want to be able to wear this apparel without any kind of guilt on our hands, then we have to demand better from our university, especially since the University of Maryland sort of markets itself as this global institution of higher learning where you have all these different ideas and backgrounds. And it just, the way that we tried to speak to our administrators was to say, well, if we are this global institution, then we want to have some sort of credibility when we talk about that. If our students and our apparel is being made in these sorts of conditions, how can we really have this sort of validity as this global institution? So that's really what it looked like on our campus, and it wasn't an easy fight at all. We got the runaround a lot from our administration. They refused to meet with us sometimes, and when they did, they would essentially be making excuses for Russell Athletic, saying that we should be more lenient with them and that they should be given another chance, things like that, that, with such serious violations that really were destructive to these people's lives, that the way that the administration was talking about was really sort of alarming to us students, because as students, if we did something that violated any code of conduct or was sort of an ethical violation, we would never get this slight slap on the wrist. We would be held accountable because we're adults. And so with a contract that was worth millions of dollars, it was even more important for us to demand accountability of Russell. So I'm really glad that we had this phenomenal victory. It makes me so happy, and I think it really sets the precedent for student power.
Right on. The raucousness is paying off. That's the way to go. So no wonder they're cutting and running, in a manner of speaking, or, hey, they're raising your tuition. Why in the world shouldn't they? You're so rambunctious. Drive you out of those universities.
What are you on?
Hey, come on. I know what a university president is. But do tell us. I mean, right now we know there's an occupation going on in California, University of Berkeley. And tell us a lot more about what's happening, both of you, with the increases in tuition and, of course, the budget cuts, too, because that's kind of same struggle, same fight, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, I'll just start by linking in how surprisingly similar this Russell case was to what we're seeing now with the budget cuts, in that the economic crisis was being used as an excuse to do something that, Russell Athletic wanted to do anyway, which in this case was get rid of unions and its Central American plants. Throughout the campaign, the number one justification Russell would give to university presidents, to concerned students and consumers, to its retailers, was that it absolutely could not reopen this plan in the economic situation we were in with the global financial crisis, et cetera, et cetera. Obviously, that turned out not to be truthful, and we see now that it was viable for Russell to reopen the plan, and probably was all along. And so now our organization nationally has really turned to seeing what we can do to support what many of our affiliates are already doing, which is fighting against the layoffs and tuition hikes that have come with budget cuts. And it's really one and the same problem in that we have university presidents and lawmakers using this economic crisis to slash funding for ethnic studies programs, cut down on the workforce and force people to do more work and raise tuition, do all of these things that likely they would have loved to have done a year ago and now feel like they have the justification to do it.
And Sana, how does this play out in University of Maryland where you are? What's happening there, which sort of parallels what's happening in California, and what are you and the students there doing?
Like Jack so eloquently put it, essentially the budget cuts are being used as there are cuts being made, but it's interesting what exactly they're cutting, because students, they've come to this university and the universities across the country for an education. And to me as a student, it's so alarming that the first things that end up getting cut are educational programs, are, you know, staff layoffs and things like that. Like, I didn't come to this university because there's a good administration here and I like the administrators. I came here because I want to get an education in whatever department that I so choose. And I think that's what's really sparking this huge flame with students, is that the things that we value the most are the ones that the administration is cutting. For example, here at the University of Maryland, we've had this associate provost for diversity and equity, and behind this guise and this veil of budget cuts, he was laid off, and then his entire position was demoted to a part-time position. And it's more than that there was someone in this position, but it's what this position has brought to the University of Maryland, which was a department of LGBT studies or Latino studies or African American studies, and this entire Nyumbaru Cultural Center, which was established in the center of our campus. And so for that person in that position to be put part-time really kind of sparked the movement on our campus. It just didn't make sense why our president is earning $355,000, but we don't
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. 300 and what?
$355,000. He almost makes the same amount as the president of the United States of America. And
he didn't even get a Nobel Prize. My goodness.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, and on top of that, the most outrageous thing that I can give an example of off the top of my head is that we just spent $250,000 on a new slogan for our school called Unstoppable Starts Here, which by itself is such
an awful slogan.
But the fact that we would pay that much money when we're in this crisis and staff are being laid off left and right, and we just don't have the money for things like Native American studies anymore, but we somehow found money for...
Right. You don't appreciate rebranding. That's the thing now. Everybody's got to rebrand.
Sana, tell us what happened when the students tried to look at the books.
This is really interesting. So the lack of transparency in this has been so ridiculous. You would think that this is some tyranny and out of university. The budget is this 800-page massive book that's kept in this one library on the other side of campus. And for students to go in and see it originally, you would have to leave all your belongings, your cell phone, your bag, your jacket, all in a separate room. You would then have to enter into this room where this massive document just sits on a table. They give you a small sheet of paper and then a small little golf-sized pencil that you can write with, and that's all you can leave with. And it wasn't until a student went in there and illegally downloaded the PDF onto his USB like drive that students first got insight on what the budget actually looked like, because we wanted a better way to argue, you know, why are we spending $10,000 to $14,000 on flowers on campus when we don't have money for Native American studies? And even then, this document has no table of contents, no index, and it's not even all the budget documents they use to decide who gets laid off or what department gets the most funding cut from. There's a whole other separate set of documents that we still don't have access to, that we're still in a fight to even get access to.
Well, so maybe they're guarding it like the Dead Sea Scrolls, because it is the emperor's new clothes. They're really so much for transparency. Well, that's what happens when you have presidents of universities getting upwards of $300,000. Well, yeah. Are you folks also in contact with the folks who are now occupying the premises in California? Is this a national movement?
Yeah, we're getting similar updates than lots of other people are. We've just launched our national efforts, and so I don't want to overemphasize any credit we can take for what's going on in California, but the United Students Against Sweatshops chapters throughout the UC system are very, very involved in this. So we're watching it very closely and see it as certainly one of the most high-profile instances of everything Sana and I have just been talking about.
This is a national movement because they're serving as such a strong inspiration and role model for the rest of us students here. I know that occupation is now something that University of Maryland students are looking into. We had an event on campus last week called Occupy Everything to talk about the new school occupation then how we can learn from that. And we even had a live video stream in from students in Santa Cruz and how things were going there. So we definitely see our struggles connected. I would even go so far saying this is a global sort of student movement because I know students in Croatia are occupying several buildings in their schools and in different countries like across Europe. So I really think that students in California are setting the precedent for student power, for their voice to really and their force to be reckoned with. So yeah, I would definitely say it's a national movement.
I got to create a button with this because I have one button that already says U.S. out of everywhere. And now
including
I can have the,
US. The
second button that would say Occupy Everything.
Occupy Everything.
Okay. Everything. Only, though, for students, because we sure don't want the U.S. to pick up on that slogan.
Yeah.
They already do that.
Occupy Everything.
So where can we find out more so we can create that rambunctious, raucous, righteous student movement that is going to be transformative, because we need some serious transforming? Who do we get in touch with?
Absolutely. Go to usas.org. That's United Students Against Sweatshops' new website, and we'll be trying to fill it up with all sorts of content about what folks are doing at the 200 schools where we have affiliates around the country. We hope that people will take inspiration from both what's going on in the UC system and what's gone on in Honduras recently to really propel forward all of our different movements.
I'm inspired.
And USAS also would take an inspiration from you. Thank you so
much. USAS,
we'll
thank
you.
You
on Real
Soon. Jack thank Mahoney, National that. Organizer of United Students Against Sweatshops, and Sonia Javed, activist and senior University of Maryland. Thanks for your social involvement. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.